is Due South, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Did you stay up later than the 81-year-old president last night? Because I did not. The end of another busy, bustling, fascinating week in North Carolina politics and news is upon us, and we have impaneled a smart and, I hope, well-caffeinated group of journalists to take us through primary results and an ear and eye toward the November election, which is now just less than 8 months away. We'll introduce those journalists to you in a moment. First, some sounds from our week.
Robinson defeated two other candidates in yesterday's Republican primary, State Treasurer Dale Falwell and Salisbury Attorney Bill Graham.
You think you're going to beat the incumbent superintendent by an 8-2 margin?
Yep. I'm hopeful. Listen, I come to that number only because as I have been fretting about what we're doing, that's the number that came to me.
Truett was quieter than usual and exchanged greetings and hugs with a few board members and department officials before the meeting began. She didn't comment on the election.
Greensboro City Council voted 5-4 to award Gioba a 3-month severance package after his resignation was announced on Tuesday. Councilmember Tammy Thurm was among those who voted against it.
In 1933, it recorded its first ever zero snowfall record at the RDU airport. This winter, it happened again.
Big surprise on Tuesday night, and it was a Republican incumbent holder of a statewide office going down. We'll get to that election of superintendent of public instruction here in a little while, and we'll do it with our panelists. They include or consist of Colin Campbell, Capital Bureau Chief WNC, Liz Schlemmer, education reporter here at North Carolina Public Radio. Steve Harrison is on the line. He's a political reporter with WFAE, NPR member station in Charlotte. And we're also joined this morning by Danielle Battaglia, Capitol Hill correspondent for the News and Observer, as well as the Charlotte Observer. Good morning, squad.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. 3 days later, I'm interested in further ruminations, takeaways, recalibrating, thoughts you've had. I spoke with Colin and Steve morning after the primary. Liz and Danielle, part of our conversation now. Colin, I'm going to start with you. What big takeaways, and if they're similar to Wednesday morning, that's, of course, just fine. What are the kind of like big top line 3 or 4 sentence summary from your perspective as to what we saw this week?
I think the biggest takeaways is that you just saw this sort of realignment in the parties, but mostly on the Republican side, towards away from the moderate, away from the middle. You saw sort of establishment figures in both parties go down in flames on their reelection bid, whether it was State Representative Michael Ray, a Democrat up in Northampton County who's worked across the aisles and voted with Republicans. He lost his reelection. Same with Senator Mike Woodard, a Democrat from Durham. And then on the Republican side, you saw State Superintendent Catherine Truett go down in defeat. Several other Republicans who had support from sort of the party leadership. So what you're looking at, particularly on the statewide races from, you know, president to governor down all the way to the council of state ballot, is Republican nominees who are probably further to the right than we have seen in previous elections. And so now the question is, that does that take the NCGOP so far to the right that they have trouble winning in a general election, or does the electorate go along with that particular shift and they do okay?
Can they pivot back, so to speak? I mean, that's obviously the, you know, the big overarching question, primary to general, but can they recalibrate, and can they— some of it is, can they recalibrate, or can they be perceived as recalibrating, and can they message in a way that's going to pick off enough of these, and there aren't very many anymore, as a reminder, these kind of middle-of-the-road undecideds. I mean, I think the undecided is almost as, like, elusive as a golden unicorn at this point that, like, you know, burps rainbows or something.
Yeah, so you almost wonder if you know, Democratic opposition researchers are just, you know, foaming at the mouth, ready to go after some of these candidates with the you know, what comments they've said, their past records, and then you have Republicans perhaps hoping that Democratic turnout is just low enough to where they do okay, even if, you know, there's more folks in the middle who decide, oh, that party's gone a little bit further to the far end of the fringe.
Right. Steve, I want to pull you in here. You've covered a lot of North Carolina elections over the years, and Colin notes that it was not a particularly good night for establishment Republicans. I think the lone exception, or I mean, there might have been several exceptions. One notable lone exception is Tim Moore, Speaker of the North Carolina House, who wins a primary, and he appears primed to move on to go to Congress in North Carolina's 14th congressional district. But Steve, talk to me, I guess, a little bit about whether or not this is reminiscent of anything you've seen where establishment Republicans found a bad night in establishment lawmakers, Republican or Democrat, found a bad night in a primary. And you know, a main top line takeaway from you from this week.
So, I mean, I can't think of anything like this. And Jeff, you know, to your point, if, you know, we kind of like move into the Charlotte area, we had, you mentioned the Tim Moore race where he won his congressional seat. But we had two others in which in the 10th District, Patrick McHenry's old seat, Gray Mills, a sitting state representative, he lost to Patrick Harrigan. And then you look at the 8th when John Bradford, a Mecklenburg state representative, he was the establishment candidate there. And Mark Harris, you know, who was at the center of the ballot scandal, beat him easily. I mean, Bradford finished third. So, you know, we had the establishment going down in some of these congressional races as well. You know, one thing I think is interesting that, you know, we just talked about, the party moving to the right. I was thinking about the attorney general's race, Jeff Jackson versus Dan Bishop. Mm-hmm. There was a time when Dan Bishop was the, in a way, kind of the biggest pinata for Democrats, like the most hard right Republican. And now, you know, the party has moved completely in Bishop's direction. He's in a way just kind of a run of the mill Republican now.
Right.
He's not that exceptional. Extraordinary.
Got for being, you know, the architect of House Bill 2, the bathroom bill. He was the lead sponsor when he served in the state house. So he's been pilloried for that for years.
Right.
You know, he had a role in some of the anti-Kevin McCarthy movement in Congress in the past year or so. But now, yeah, if you compare him to Mark Robinson, Michelle Morrow, the candidate who won the Superintendent of Public Instruction nomination, he doesn't seem that far out there by comparison. Like, he's almost the, I'd hate to ever use the word establishment on Dan Bishop, but compared to those two, he kind of goes that direction.
Let me jump in and use the words normalized and tame. And Steve, Colin, anybody else, please push back on that if you want. But to underscore your point there, Colin, Dan Bishop carried through House Bill 2, which was this monumental news story for the better part of a year, led to all these kind of economic boycotts, was a huge contributor in Pat McCrory losing his reelection bid in 2016. Dan Bishop was at the heart of that. He did not have a lot of friends, as I recall, within his own caucus in the North Carolina House at the time. But now he is very much just kind of a standard bearer of the conservative effort in North Carolina. To your point, Steve, it's very interesting.
Yeah, and he didn't even have a primary this week. I mean, the fact that the Republicans were so unified behind him as their candidate for attorney general, no one else bothered to file, so he wasn't on the ballot this week.
We have not had a Republican attorney general in almost a century and a half. Just a little bit of civics there. Liz Schlemmer, WNC education reporter. For my money and plenty of other people's money, however much money or however little money that may be, the big surprise this week was a sitting superintendent, a Republican incumbent, Catherine Truitt, being defeated in the primary by Michelle Morrow. Just give us your reaction to it as it played out Tuesday into Wednesday. Were you thinking this was ripe for an upset, or were you like, oh my gosh, what's happening here?
Yeah, I was surprised. I think many people were surprised at watching the results come in that night. At first, it was very clear that Michelle Morrow had this support in rural counties, which is where we were seeing election results come in first. It was a very tight race all throughout the night. And then it just started becoming more and more apparent that there weren't enough counties left, there weren't enough votes left for Superintendent Truitt to hold on to her seat. It was a close race, 52-48, so, you know, just a 4% margin there.
Wasn't the 80-20 she forecast on this show, though?
It was not. That is true.
Michelle Morrow did this on something of a shoestring budget, and she did it with a small social media following. But as we talked about on our Wednesday recap of primary election results, part of our Purple Ballot series, Colin Campbell noted then that this was done through very much a grassroots infrastructure and utilizing Facebook groups and really tapping into some of the energy that is existent and I think is going to continue to be really important as we barrel toward November, as we think about certain factions on the right, what they want within public education, what they're upset about within public education. Michelle Morrow is somebody who ran for school board in Wake County once, and she is somebody who has been speaking to a lot of these groups across the last several months, and it paid dividends here on Tuesday. Here is just a clip from some of her campaigning earlier this winter.
Hey, Patriots! We are here. You guys can see there's a gaggle in front.
There's a gaggle behind. We are on our way to the Ellipse, because that's where our president asks us to come. We are here to take back America. We are here to stop the steal. We are here to ensure that President Trump gets four more years. And we are here to ensure that the United States never becomes a communist country.
Okay, so my bad. Let's back up there. Before there was the campaigning, there was Michelle Morrow on Capitol Hill on January 6th of 2021. Correct?
Yes. So that is her video that she put on TikTok when she was in Washington on January 6th. She's just kind of, you know, walking along on the street. I don't know that she was, you know, busting through any doors or anything. But she was there. That is something that is, you know, a lot of people have taken notice, and she won this race.
The word magification is a word that has kicked around at times. I can't remember if it made it into our Wednesday morning program or not, but I think it's an appropriate word as we think about this shift that continues to either pull or, I mean, if it's a flag in the ground, and it's just where the Republican Party is at this point. We're going to discuss the magification of the Republican Party a little bit more on the other side. We're also going to talk about voter turnout. It was low, and it was particularly low in one municipal county in North Carolina, and that could signal some real concerns for Democrats come November. Stick with us. Colin Campbell, Liz Schlemmer, Danielle Battaglia, and Steve Harrison are with us for our North Carolina Friday News Roundup. My name is Jeff Tiberi. This is Due South on listener-supported WUNC. Welcome back. This is the Friday North Carolina News Roundup on Due South. I'm Jeff Tiberi. On this day in 1865, General William Tecumseh Sherman, having left a path of destruction in South Carolina, arrived here in North Carolina. He set up camp near Laurinburg, which is in Scotland County. Now, according to author John G. Barrett, who wrote The Civil War in North Carolina, some Union soldiers thought that the area looked, quote, like real Northern, with its small farms and nice, white, tidy dwellings, close quote. A day later, Sherman's army entered Robeson County, where Union troops crossed the Lumber River at the Gilchrist Bridge and entered the county. That night, General Sherman took refuge at Bethel Presbyterian Church. And again, according to the author, General Sherman slept on one of the wooden pews for the night in that church, and someone left a penciled memo in the church Bible stating, "Please pray for old Abe by order W.T. Sherman," close quote. As a reminder, North Carolina birthdays, anniversaries, and historical nuggets are welcome here on Due South for our Friday News Roundup. You can send us an email, duesouth@wunc.org, or if you dare, find me on the X, once known as the Twitter, at J_TIBS. Colin Campbell of WUNC, his colleague, our colleague, Lee Schlemmer, is here as well. Steve Harrison on the line from WFAE in Charlotte, and Danielle Battaglia, McClatchy correspondent on Capitol Hill. Danielle, hello, good morning. I joked off the top that, you know, the 81-year-old president stayed up awfully late last night. Tell us a little bit about these election results in North Carolina through the D.C. lens. Were there any surprises from your perspective, and or was there any scuttlebutt that you were engaging with in the days that followed?
I thought it was interesting because predictions that I was hearing from campaign advisors and people in various circles did not turn out the way that they said it would. And so just watching the race that night was fascinating. I think, you know, the two things that are really standing out to me are the two runoffs between Mark Walker and Addison McDowell in the 6th district and Kelly Daughtry and Brad Knott in the 13th district. Both men being Brad Knott and Mark Walker, the second place finishers, have said that they want to have a runoff. And so we are expecting that on May 14th.
Tuesday, May 14th, the second primary or runoff here in North Carolina. You mentioned these two congressional districts, the 6th, which is Greensboro, Guilford County, and, you know, a morphing northern, and then the 13th, which kind of hugs the triangle. Danielle, talk to us a little bit about what your expectation is for if there's somebody who kind of has an advantage going into these second primaries, or if it just what you're teeing up or anticipating.
Well, it'll be interesting to watch because obviously a second primary, it's a different voter class because they've got to be people who are paying attention to the fact that there is a second primary. I think Addison McDowell is probably the favorite to win. Mark Walker has had a couple missteps going into the first primary, although he is technically, I don't know if you can consider him an incumbent, but he has held that seat for three terms with a break in between, with Kathy Manning holding it for the last two terms, I believe. And Kelly Daughtry and Brad Knott, I think it's anyone's game over there.
We saw this week that Brad, unless I'm confusing candidates, and I'll just plead a little bit of like sleep deprivation and jet lag at this point of the week, but Brad Knott, did he just not get the endorsement of President Trump here in the former President Trump last couple of days, or am I confusing
that
with?
I don't think so. Okay, thing to watch in the runoff is Trump, I think, only weighed in on a handful of, or just a few of the congressional races in the primary. He supported Addison McDowell, I think partly on the strength of his son's relationship with McDowell over bonding over hunting trips or something like that. He stayed out of the 13th congressional, which, because that had 14 candidates, was probably a strategic move just not to jump in there, as unpredictable as that was with an endorsement. So I think it will be interesting to see, does he get behind Knott or Daughtry or stay out? Does Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who also has an endorsement that can carry some weight, does he jump in there in that race? I think those are all things to watch. We know both candidates have already spent a couple $1 million, not in part through the super PAC that's backing him. We can expect that spending to continue. So the ad war that has been taking over the Triangle TV airwaves, that's going to continue. And then the sixth, I'll be interested to see if there's continued spending against Mark Walker. He had some PACs that some national groups that seemed to not necessarily be supporting one of his opponents so much as they just really didn't like him and didn't want him to win. And will they continue to be a factor in that? I also want, can Walker win back any of the endorsements that he had and then lost or maybe never had in the first place? I mean, Danielle, do you think anyone's going to revisit Mark Walker and whether to support him, or are they just going to be like, nah, let's not go there?
I mean, when I was talking to the people who were pulling endorsements, they were pretty grumpy. I can't see them coming back, but you never know. Maybe they don't like Addison. I didn't get that sense, but yeah, I don't know. I don't see that happening.
Yeah, he's got a lot of relationships from his time as a lobbyist where he had endorsements from at least the Raleigh legislative political circle, because they all know him for his work lobbying for Blue Cross Blue Shield. And I think NC League of Municipalities before that has sort of helped him get that sort of, establishment backing in addition to being Trump endorsed.
As we think about this, I'm going to turn back to the word magification. It's worth pointing out Mark Walker, former three-term member of Congress, and Catherine Truitt, the sitting superintendent. These are not like just right of center or like country club Republicans who do a lot of bipartisan commingling. Like, these are very conservative people, and they're not conservative enough, or they're not Trumpy enough, for the party to coalesce around them at this point. Just to kind of go next level on that point, I want to pivot to, I guess, another subthread of this, and then turn to Steve Harrison to attribute this to Steve Harrison. He shared this article with me via the email last night. I'm going to read a quote from an online newsletter that was released Wednesday. It comes from the NC Chamber. Okay, I'll read the quote, and then I'm going to turn to you, Steve, for analysis. But it reads, quote, "When both parties move to the opposite ends of the political spectrum, it erodes the quiet bipartisan work necessary to move our state forward. Moderating voices in each caucus will be replaced with partisan ideologues that cause division and create controversy." Close quote. That is a right of center group that the NC Chamber did not seem to me as the reader to be particularly pleased with some of the results on Tuesday. Steve, take it away from there. What else did you read into that online newsletter?
Yeah, I think there were two. There were two of the Council of State races that they were disappointed in. One was on the Republican primary for Labor Commissioner Luke Farley, finishing first ahead of State Representative John Hardister. That was a big one. And then, of course, the school superintendent race with Michelle Morrow. Those are, I think, were the two big ones. They also lost. They had invested money in nine legislative races and lost four. So I thought it was just fascinating to see them. I mean, Jeff, you talked about kind of this center-right Republican. That's the chamber. And they found themselves on the outs and completely perplexed. Now, you could argue, one of their quotes was, in many instances, previously unknown candidates defeated sitting legislators with stronger qualifications, pristine voting records, and significantly more funding. Well, perhaps that's not, I guess I'm kind of thinking about, you know, kind of this idea of like, well, they had more money. How could they possibly lose? And you know, maybe that's maybe that's not such a bad thing.
And I would get, I'm going to come to Lee Schlimmer here in just a moment. I want to remind listeners, we've got Steve Harrison, Danielle Battaglia, Colin Campbell, and Lee Schlimmer here with us on our North Carolina Friday News Roundup. And quickly on money, I will only point out that money, while very important, is not a deciding factor in elections. Donald Trump, of course, did not have as much money as Hillary Clinton 8 years ago. There are other obvious and prominent examples. But Lee Schlimmer, did you want to touch on turnout?
Yeah. Can we talk about low voter turnout and how that makes the difference in this and in some of these upsets and surprises that we had? You know, I'm thinking about the superintendent race. Some of what we saw is that Michelle Morrow went out, had time to do this because she wasn't already running a large department, but was going out and talking to these Republican clubs and, you know, really hitting the campaign trail. And those are your primary voters.
And I think, too, when you have low turnout, you do get the people who are, they go to these sort of Republican gatherings. The other challenge with low turnout, because we had reporters from WUNC out at the polls talking to voters about what was driving them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them sort of was this like eat your spinach message of like, well, I know this is my civic duty and I'm not particularly excited about any of this. And you have to assume those are also the people who, and I'm guilty of this sometimes when I vote, is, you know, the procrastination of like researching the candidates the night before. And when you do that, and particularly in some of these low information races like superintendent of public instruction that didn't get that much news coverage, you might be relying on the candidates' websites. You might not have a good sense for what that position does. When I talked to Republicans before that race, you know, was called, they thought, you know, there's a lot of misinformation about from voters about what the superintendent of public instruction does, to what extent they can set policy, to what extent they are simply administrating the policies that are set by the legislature. And I think Morrow was sort of able to capitalize on that confusion by promising to do things that maybe she wouldn't have the power to do if she actually had that role. But certainly those messages resonated with voters in a low information race.
It's the old free soda for everybody if you're running for student council president, right? Like, can you actually do that? No, but if you say you do and you convince everybody, you might have the votes and then you might be student council president. Maybe a bad analogy. Turnout, Liz, as you point to it, I think turnout is so interesting on several different levels. Let me, I guess, say a couple things quickly. 24% was the turnout on Tuesday night, and including the 17-day early voting period. That is down 20% from the primary turnout in 2020. So that's low. And I look at this race, all these races, as they're manifesting, as they're crystallizing across the 8 months. And to your point, Liz, and part of the reason Michelle Morrow won and upset Catherine Truitt on Tuesday night is because turnout was low. And those who were turning out were Trump acolytes. Now, of course, turnout will increase in November. But is it going to increase to 2020 levels? There is a fatigue. Like, there is a collective fatigue. I can feel it in this room. I can feel it when I talk to people. And who knows? Like, we will find out across the next 8 months. But I think it is a distinct possibility that we do not get the kind of turnout that we got 4 years ago, maybe even or 8 years ago, because people are like, ugh, I can't do it.
And that makes it so much harder to predict because you don't know whether the turnout's going to be weaker on the Democratic side or on the Republican side. If Democrats think that, oh, Joe Biden's too old, or I'm not happy with his policy on Israel and the Middle East, and they don't show up, or if Republicans decide, oh, I'm sick of Trump, and I can't bring myself to vote for Biden, so I'm not going to show up. Those are all distinct possibilities and make polling incredibly difficult to, you know, try to parse through.
Steve Harrison.
I want to jump in real quick talking about turnout. On the Democratic side, no big surprise that it was lower than 2020 because Biden's an incumbent. But I went back and looked at like 30 years of this. There were two other years, elections with incumbent Democratic presidents, Clinton in 96, Obama in 2012. Turnout on the Democratic side on Tuesday was significantly lower than those two elections. It was at about 13% of eligible voters, really low. And so some of that, I mean, I assume we had some unaffiliateds who went into the Republican primary to vote for Nikki Haley. That's part of it. But I don't think that explains some of the fatigue and unenthusiasm on the Democratic side. That may turn around, but for now it was really, really low.
One other little subplot here, which I do think is worth mentioning, I'm going to mention it a lot in the next few months, is that third-party candidates do exist in this ecosystem as potential spoilers. The one example that I do like to pivot to is from 2016 when Roy Cooper beat Pat McCrory by less than 11,000 votes. There was a libertarian in that race who received about 102,000 votes. His name was Lon Cecil. Without Lon Cecil in that race, Pat McCrory probably gets a second four-year term in the executive mansion. This is not me trying to do revisionist history. This is just to say, you bring turnout down, the margins can become even tighter, and in some of these races, we will have a libertarian in the gubernatorial race here, we'll have a libertarian in the lieutenant governor's race. These are third-party candidates that could tip the scales.
Yeah, Green Party will have a factor in there. There's still the on the presidential level, the question about whether No Labels, which has official party designation in North Carolina, can be on the ballot if they so choose, if they decide to run a candidate for president. And then I guess the other sort of weird thing is that the Constitution Party, which is like the ultra conservative, you think that the Republicans are too liberal type party, they don't have ballot access anymore. They did a couple years ago, and that sort of offset the impact of the Green Party. And again, these are really, really tiny numbers, but if it's really, really close, it could make a difference.
We had a state Supreme Court race 4 years ago that was decided by, 403 votes, 401. This was out of 6.5 million ballots cast. It was down to 400 votes.
We are often a very close to 50-50 state, just sort of across the board.
Danielle Battaglia on Capitol Hill, I'm interested to ask you potentially two throwaway questions, but that's what happens when my voice gets a little scratchy at the end of a long week. Number one is, as a reminder, we think about our North Carolina's congressional delegation, and five members are leaving. Three of them are Democrats who were gerrymandered out, and there were two Republicans who decided not to run for re-election. One is Patrick McHenry, the interim speaker last fall. It seems as though he just had enough of Congress. He did not run for re-election. And Dan Bishop, who mentioned earlier here in the program, is running for attorney general. Five out of 14 Congress members are departing. This is going to look This is going to be a very different delegation from North Carolina come 2025. How does that matter? Is that going to have an impact on North Carolina, the typical North Carolinian?
I mean, so right now we have a 7-7 split in Congress. So it's 7 Democrats, 7 Republicans, which is pretty, I have no words because it's been a long week. It reflects what North Carolina is. We're a purple state, so it's pretty reflective of the counties that we have. So now we're going to most likely a 10-3-1 split, 10 Republicans, 3, actually I shouldn't say 1, but 10 Republicans, 3 Democrats, and then we have that one swing district in the
TBD.
First congressional district. Yeah, we don't know if it's going to be Republican or Democrat. And so we're going to get a very conservative brand in Congress with a very purple state. I think it's not reflective of our state. Our representation is going to look different and, different people representing you. It's going to look different. Also, McHenry's been there for, I think, 20 years now.
Sounds
and
right.
is leaving us.
10 terms. That's a lot of institutional knowledge and experience.
That's a lot.
Right?
He is probably the most powerful Republican we have in Congress right now for North Carolina.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And we're losing that. So that's a big deal for us.
Danielle Battaglia, you've seen her byline in the News and Observer, Charlotte Observer. She is McClatchy's Capitol Hill correspondent. Another maybe a throwaway here. And if my voice is cracking, I hope you're all laughing at me at home because I was laughing on the way in, realizing my voice was cracking today. Danielle, the State of the Union was last night. At first I saw this and I went, who in the world scheduled the State of the Union this week? Like, this is so foolish. And then I thought, maybe this isn't foolish. Maybe this was a moment that Biden and the Biden administration were trying to seize on. But I don't know. So please, you tell me, why was the State of the Union this week?
Would you believe it's not up to President Biden to do this? It's up to House Speaker Mike Johnson to make the decision. And I'm assuming there's some strategy in it. I have no idea what it was, but I can say I was livid for like the month and a half leading up to this because
Johnson looked so excited by that speech.
His eye roll is like, he rolled his eyes more than anyone I've seen since maybe middle school. He was in charge of scheduling it. So we went straight Super Tuesday. Then we had a vote on the appropriation bills. And then we went into State of the Union. And today the Senate is voting on the appropriation bills. So he timed this really well.
We've got a couple of minutes left in this segment. I am jumping around, admittedly, here. But we're going to go from Danielle Battaglia back to Steve Harrison because there is a thread as it pertains to turnout, and I don't want to get to the end of the show and think, oh, crap, I didn't ask Steve about the terrible turnout that is more specifically even more terrible and has kind of a greater stench in Mecklenburg County. You've got about a minute, Steve. Tell us just how bad turnout was in your county on Tuesday.
Jeff, stench is a perfect word. We have 100 counties in North Carolina. Mecklenburg had the 97th worst turnout. Now, of course, part of that, we were a very Democratic county. There was not a lot of enthusiasm on the Democratic side. But if you go over to the triangle, I mean, Durham County, very Democratic, had far more people turn out. Wake County, far more people turn out. Same as Guilford. This has been a long-running problem in Charlotte. And there is growing alarm about, are the things being done to fix this? I mean, if you look at the state party level, the North Carolina Democratic Party has been putting all of its emphasis on rural, 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 which I think is a great strategy. But there are so many votes in Mecklenburg County, and any Democrat who wants to win statewide must get them.
There are more Democrats, please fact check me here, in Mecklenburg County, registered Democrats, than in any other county in the old North State.
That's right. Wake County now has more total registered voters,
sure,
but the biggest pool of Democrats, registered Democrats, is Mecklenburg.
It'll be interesting to follow turnout in many of its facets as we move toward November. That is Steve Harrison, political reporter for WFAE in Charlotte. On the line as well is Danielle Battaglia, Capitol Hill correspondent for McClatchy. Colin Campbell and Liz Schlemmer, the colleagues from WNC, are here in studio. On the other side, we'll keep chatting politics and also tell you about a first in recorded history. It was an unwintery winter here in the Triangle. Stay tuned. This is Due South on listener-supported WNC. Welcome back. It's Due South on listener-supported WUNC. This Sunday marks Jim Valvano's birthday. The legendary, colorful figure who arrived in Raleigh in 1980 led the North Carolina State Wolfpack men's basketball team for a decade, amassing 209 wins, two regular season ACC championships, two more ACC tournament titles, and, but of course, the Cinderella of Cinderella runs, a 1983 national championship. Valvano was diagnosed with metastatic cancer in 1992. He died the following spring at the age of just 47. The V Foundation, named in his honor and started at the end of his life, has since served as a lasting part of his legacy, having raised more than $350 million for cancer research since his death in 1993. Valvano is buried in Raleigh's Oakwood Cemetery. His gravestone reads, "Take time every day to laugh, to think, to cry." Jim Valvano would have turned 78 years old on Sunday. All right, back to it. I'm Jeff here in the Durham studio with Colin and Liz. Danielle's on the line. So too is Steve with member station WFE in Charlotte. So many different places to go. We were talking about turnout earlier, and I want to go from those numbers to the fundraising numbers. A tweet that struck me this week comes from our own Colin Campbell, and it reads, "Another sign of big fundraising in the governor's race, Josh Stein campaign reports raising $500,000 since the primary." The race is getting lots of national attention this week. Colin, say that one more time. I think your mic might have been off.
Yeah.
How many days?
It's 2 days. So, yeah, I got this information from his campaign on Thursday around midday. And so this is since, like, the race was called for him Tuesday night. And this is a sign. And I've seen this just in the questions that I've been getting from our national media partners here in the public radio space, but elsewhere as well. I think there was a whole Daily Show segment about it. There's been other cable news segments about it. Like, the rest of America has somehow woken up to Mark Robinson as the Republican nominee for governor in North Carolina, and that's created a lot of energy among people on the left who are very concerned about the things that Mark Robinson has said about LGBTQ people, about women, about various other topics, and they seem to be donating very heavily to Josh Stein as a result, and Stein is able to rake it in. I mean, this is already an expensive race. Both candidates have raised north of $10 million up to this point, and it's only going to be even more now that we're into the general election cycle.
I have heard an estimate of upwards of $70 million is what one of these two candidates may very well raise. We're going to see north of $100 million combined from the two major party candidates in the gubernatorial race. Steve Harrison, do you care to throw an estimate out there and or just touch on this huge pot of money as it pertains to 2024? What kinds of campaign finance things are you tracking?
I mean, I would, in terms of a dollar amount, Jeff, it's hard to say, but just this overall theme of how this race will dominate the national media. I mean, we saw it yesterday, a day after a primary, there was that story that dropped about Robinson, you know, that was perhaps taken out of context about going back to before women wanted to vote. I mean, there will just be a steady stream over the next 8 months of story after story. And the national reporters who are going to parachute in and cover this story, I don't think we've seen anything like it in North Carolina.
I do want to throw a little bit of cold water on this gubernatorial race, as I did on Wednesday morning, and I welcome pushback from anybody. The gubernatorial race is important, of course. You've got the power of the bully pulpit. You're the executive of the state. However, at the same time, North Carolina's governor is one of the least powerful in the country. There is no line item veto. There are really some limitations as we think about appointment powers and other just executive functioning. The most important thing as we think about state government is whether or not Republicans maintain a supermajority or margins that are comfortable enough where they can push through supermajorities and overrides. Is that a fair assessment, or would you want to, I don't know, curtail that in any way, Colin?
To an extent, that's true, but I think the challenge for Democrats is they want to remain in any way relevant in North Carolina politics going into 2025. They have to do two things. They've got to keep the governor's mansion, and they've got to break the supermajority in the state legislature so that, potentially future Governor Josh Stein can veto something and not have it immediately overridden. If all of his vetoes are overridden, or if there is a Republican in the governor's mansion and legislators don't have a supermajority, but they do have a simple majority, which pretty much based on the way the lines have been gerrymandered is almost a guarantee that they will have at least a majority, that allows them to enact whatever they want to do. And the Democrats don't have the courts. They don't have really any other power in other branches of government. So it becomes effectively a Republican state for at least the next 2 to 4 years.
Well said. If that wasn't emblematic in the improvement of the Capitol Bureau chief role at WUNC, I don't know what is, if anything, in the ethos. This is Due South. This is the Friday North Carolina News Roundup on North Carolina Public Radio. Earlier this week, I was able to catch up with Lily Knepp, senior regional reporter from Blue Ridge Public Radio. She's based in Silva. The station is based in Asheville. For a view of the election from Western North Carolina, she's been following the Republican candidates for governor the last few months and also reporting on the role of religion in that race and some of the influences of religion in the mountainous regions and reaches of North Carolina. And I asked her how she thinks that has impacted election results.
Yeah, I think, you know, Mark Robinson has positioned himself with evangelical conservatives. And I went to that Faith and Freedom rally in Franklin that you're referring to, where Robinson, you know, got up at a church for this political event to talk about his position. And actually, I talked to Sheila Ash here in Silva today, and she said that she definitely thinks of Mark Robinson as a Christian candidate.
Sheila Ash, Silva, North Carolina. I'm representing Mark Robinson for governor of the state of North Carolina.
How important do you think the evangelical vote is in, you know, winning this election for Mark Robinson and other conservative candidates?
I think it's very important. The Christian people are truly getting out the vote.
Do you think that a lot of them are coming out for this election?
Yes, I do. That's my feeling from here at the Board of Elections in Jackson County.
And, you know, sitting with Sheila at the kind of Republican tent in Jackson County was George Sutton, and he also was voting for Mark Robinson. Both said they actually were supporters of Chuck Edwards' Republican challenger, Christian Reagan from Clay County. But he talked a little bit about what was most important to him and his priorities in the election. And I think they went beyond religion.
I live going towards Cullowhee out on 107.
What made you want to come out and vote today?
Because being a vet, I stand with Christian Reagan and I stand with Mark Robinson. And I feel like they are good people and that we got to do something on the border. Being a vet, we've got homeless vets out there that needs help. And that's the reason I like them and stand beside them. Mm-hmm.
Do you identify as a Christian?
Yes, absolutely. And I believe that they are good Christian people and willing to stand and fight for this country. This country is not what it used to be. And it's time to take the country back.
And I think, you know, listening to Mr. Sutton, you really hear that, you know, there are other issues that aren't necessarily religious that he's focused on, you know, affordable housing, being able to stay in the place where he's living. And so I think that's what's really hard when we're talking about turnout and is evangelical turnout driving the choices that are being made in this election? What's sending people to the polls? And often it isn't just one thing, Jeff.
Let's roll it forward to the general election, 8 months, a mere 8 months away. How much of a focus do you anticipate continuing to spend on religion? And do you think that is going to be a driving factor in some of these races moving forward?
I mean, I think it'll be really interesting. Most of the races here in the West are contested as we head into the general. There are both Democrats and Republicans for the rep and Senate houses. And it'll be interesting to see how people talk about religion. You know, Democrats also talk about religion. So I think especially here in far western North Carolina, where people, you know, have a lot of discussions about religion, we'll see what comes out. It's not just Republicans who kind of have that stamp on discussing morality in politics.
Right, of course. And they're not a monolith, of course. You spoke with the North Carolina branch of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. This is a Georgia-based political advocacy organization. You spoke to them several times just for some of the reporting that you've done in recent weeks. I'm curious if you've had any indication from them about turnout as it pertains to Super Tuesday.
Yeah, I mean, the Faith and Freedom Coalition is a national group. And what they said was that they really want to get every evangelical Christian out. And they think if they do that, then they will be able to win the election overall in the White House for Donald Trump.
That's Lily Knepp, senior regional reporter for Blue Ridge Public Radio. She spoke with us earlier this week. We have collected reports from WHQR in Wilmington, WFDD in Winston-Salem, and of course WFAE in Charlotte, where Steve Harrison joins us on the line from as well. We had a collaboration earlier this week on Tuesday. Would encourage you to check out that election preview on Super Tuesday itself, and then we had an hour recapping some of the results as well. That's on DueSouthRadio.org, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you do that on-demand listening. I want to move from the West to the East real quick before we say goodbye to our Capitol Bureau Chief Colin Campbell, because he has an interview to get to. The one congressional race we have not talked about that much, the one congressional race in North Carolina that is expected to be competitive in November is Democrat Don Davis versus, no, not Sandy Smith, the Republican. Sandy Smith did not prevail. Who will Don Davis take on in the first congressional district, and what can you tell us about this district, Colin?
So Lori Buckout, who's a military veteran, won that nomination over Sandy Smith, who had run, I think, the past two cycles in that district, very much the Trumpiest candidate you could possibly get, a variety of factors that, you know, would lead me to that conclusion. What was interesting about that race is that the U.S. House leadership, their PAC, spent a good bit of money behind Buckout. They felt like she was going to be the more competitive candidate of the two in that one swing district we have. And I'll also note that that district has become even swingier because of the new lines make it a little bit more competitive for Republicans. Certainly Don Davis, the incumbent Democrat, could very easily keep his seat, but that also is going to be really close with Buckout that race. That's, you're going to see a lot of spending in that, because pretty much the other 13 congressional races in North Carolina, kind of a foregone conclusion at this point. They either lean heavily Republican or heavily Democratic.
Swingy, I like the word squishy as well. So I just want to make sure I'm hearing you correctly, Colin. There are lines, and there's such thing as too Trumpy for Republicans right now?
Potentially. I mean, that was the interesting aspect of that, was the one sort of, I guess, exception to the rule of the Trumpier anti-establishment candidates winning Republican primaries. That particular district, Sandy Smith didn't win. And I think some of that may just been the electability argument. You know, you get that a lot. But in Smith's case, she's now lost twice. So it was pretty easy to make the case that, oh, you nominate her again, you might lose again.
You are heading out the door momentarily. You're going to interview the presumptive Democratic nominee for governor, Josh Stein, the sitting attorney general. Share with our listeners, if you would, one thing that you plan to ask Attorney General Stein.
So I'll be really curious to hear his thoughts on to what extent this can be a policy race. Can he bring up policies like the economic policy he brought up this week about a earned income type tax credit? with all the noise of things Mark Robinson has said and the national attention on Mark Robinson and what he's said and what he's advocated for. I think that's going to be an interesting line for Josh Stein to walk as he campaigns in the general.
Colin Campbell, WUNC Capitol Bureau Chief. As always, thank you, Colin.
Thanks, Jeff.
Let's pivot to policy, but just not in the governor's race. Well, maybe to the governor's race, but other elements of this. I mentioned that statewide collaboration a couple moments ago, and we heard from WHQR News Director Ben Shockman. And Ben Shockman's his big takeaway on Wednesday morning was that Michelle Morrow outperformed Mark Robinson and Donald Trump in New Hanover County. As a reminder, Michelle Morrow is the Republican grassroots candidate who upset Catherine Truitt, the state superintendent. So I'm interested to hear from you, Liz Schlemmer. What education, I mean, is it just education? Is it going to be vouchers? Is it going to be book bans? I mean, is education going to bubble to the top? And I'm asking you to, procrastinate and go crystal ball here. But from an education policy standpoint, what is it that you think might have the most influence in these next few months?
Well, I didn't really see Michelle Morrow talking about policies the way that Truitt talked about policies, right? Truitt had all these big reforms that she's been pursuing that are really policy pieces, changing how teachers teach literacy or math or trying to restructure teacher pay. Michelle Morrow is talking about things like critical race theory still.
Right.
You know, she's talking about parents' rights issues. And I am curious to see what her policy positions will be. I know that she's concerned about school discipline, but the kinds of things she was talking about really played to this primary audience. So I think we have to, wait and see what policies is she going to take up in this campaign.
Final few moments of the North Carolina Friday News Roundup here on Due South. Want to encourage you to hit your email and let us know if you have any questions about real estate. We're doing a show with two real estate experts next week, and we would love to hear your questions in advance. Find us on the email, duesouth@wunc.org. I do have, two non-political updates or non-political things I just want to drop on here. One is we've got a basketball game tomorrow. We've got the Tar Heels and the Blue Devils, 6:30 Cameron Indoor Stadium. If Duke wins, it's a share of the ACC title. If Carolina wins, they win the ACC championship outright. I think many will be watching. I know I'll be watching with my children and my family and my parents and all those people. Steve Harrison, real quick, because I don't know this and I'm just throwing you on the spot. Do you have a North Carolina basketball rooting alliance or no?
I actually grew up in Louisiana, but I grew up starting to watch college basketball in the Jordan era, so I've always pulled for them, even long before I moved to North Carolina 17 years ago. So I'll pull for the Tar Heels this weekend.
All right. I was just curious. There was no right answer there, just for the record. We welcome Duke fans. Don Baumgartner, Don Vaughn is a friend of the program, and she, of course, is a big Duke fan. One other non-political related note, and that is for the first time in recorded history, the Triangle had a winter with exactly zero snow. There have been previous winters with trace amounts of snow, but this is the first time with absolutely no snow. And if you're wondering, because I was, the astronomical winter ends March 19th. The meteorological winter, that's a big word, runs December 1st through February 29th. We are just about out of time, so I am going to have to wrap things up there. Steve Harrison, political reporter at WFAE in Charlotte, Danielle Battaglia, McClatchy, Capitol Hill correspondent, and Liz Schlemmer, WUNC education reporter. A big thanks to all of you for your analysis. Hopefully you'll get some sleep this weekend.
Thanks, Jeff.
Due South is available to you each weekday morning at 10 o'clock here on North Carolina Public Radio. If you missed anything, please head over to WUNC.org or, again, iTunes, Spotify, wherever it is that you snag your podcasts. A few thank yous to go around as we wrap up our week. On the other side of the glass, Jenny Lawson, Denarius Thomas, and Aaron Kiever. Due South is produced by Stacia Brown, Cole Del Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Thanks to our panelists again, as well as Lily Knapp. For my co-host, Leonita Inge, my name is Jeff Tiberi. We'll talk to you again on Monday when we chat sports gambling.